Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're here at every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between personal well-being, community well-being, societal well-being, and what's going on with our ecological habitat here on planet Earth. We talk about policy, advocacy, on options for recovery, healing, and restoration for our society and the long-term vitality and continuation of life on Earth. And we've been doing this on the show for the last 9 years. I am a longstanding journalist in these particular categories of environment, health, food, policy, popular attitudes, and media. On today's show, I am really thrilled to have with us someone who is, I would say, the ideal thought leader and expert to be unpacking last night's Democratic debate on CNN with us today. He is a law professor, Robert C. Hockett, the Edward Cornell Professor of Law and Professor of Public Policy at Cornell, as well as a senior advisor to Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, focusing on a number of policies, but most significantly in terms of the nexus that we've been discussing, the Green New Deal and all public policies radiating from that. On today's program, we'll be discussing the aftermaths of last night's debate, as well as the revelations in terms of what went on there with Bob Hockett, and I'm thrilled to have you with us today on Connect the Dots. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Allison. It's great to be with you. And also just one quick sort of caveat. It's probably a bit too exalted to say I'm a senior advisor to any of these wonderful folks, but I do various jobs for them over time, helping to draft statutes and kind of conceive of statutes and the like. So it's kind of more an ad hoc freelance sort of thing rather than, you know, a formal appointment of any kind. But okay. But that being said, those are my heroes, and those are the three I work most closely with.
That's wonderful. Thank you for that correction.
Oh, sure.
And also, I mean, these are the great people who are coming through to really help the society move forward and recover from, the devolution that has kind of taken over. One of the things that occurred to me as I was kind of looking at some of the topics of what was revealed and came forth at last night's debate is the fact that today on this program, you and I will have more time to unpack the issues than the candidates themselves were accorded.
You mean we get more than 15 seconds each?
Yeah, exactly. And I, wow. I think that in and of itself is actually quite telling goes to the heart of my ongoing critique of this entire structure and process of, this parade of candidates, some of whom, poll very low. Nobody even knows who they are or why they're there, although that has become clearer now that we've seen them in action. So, what would your initial comments be about the actual debate structure itself in terms of what we saw last night on CNN?
Yeah, so it was actually quite interesting, I thought, in that, there were various things I think you and I were both dissatisfied about in connection with the first set of debates last month. And at the time, I thought it was probably largely in owing to the format. Basically to the fact that, nobody had more than about 30 seconds to address any question or to try to make any kind of point. And I still think that the format is, quite subpar, to put it generously. But on the other hand, one caveat I'm sort of tempted to introduce now is that it does seem as though the format is something that in some cases can be surmountable, at least in as much as I thought Bernie and Liz managed to get their points across quite effectively and managed to inject a great deal of substance into the proceedings, and so did some of the others. I mean, Delaney, I think, is ridiculous as a so-called Democrat, but, he was able to get his quote-unquote points in as well, and hence to sort of joint issue or sort of sharpen the issue between fake Democrats and real Democrats. And again, I think you and I agree that Marianne Williamson, for example, got a lot of substance in there as well, notwithstanding the uncongeniality of the format to anything even remotely approaching substantivity. I guess that would be the initial thought. Is it still a bad format? but somehow or another, the candidates seem to have adapted since June in a manner that has enabled them to, you know, actually to get some real substance across, notwithstanding that format.
That's very true. I mean, what did you, just as an overall, think of the quality of the host questions from the CNN hosts? I mean,
I thought the quality, again, this is a pretty low bar to start from, but I did think the quality of the questioning was better this time than last time, in at least two senses. First of all, I think they were the questioners were much more specific about what precisely they wanted to ask about. They, in effect, defined the particular questions that, you know, sort of opposing pairs of candidates had sort of opposing positions on. And that ended up enabling, I think, the various candidates to kind of maybe to frame or to sort of specify their answers a bit more effectively. It enabled them to give more specific answers, let's say. So the issues were slightly better defined precisely because I think the questioners posed questions about specific matters that you could almost always pick at least two people up there on the stage who were on record as having opposed positions on it. The other respect in which it was a little bit better was, I think, you know, I think Bernie was spot on in telling Mr. Tapper that his question was essentially a repetition of a Republican talking point. I've been waiting to hear that for a long time, and I was thrilled to hear it. And Bernie was quite right about it. But the one thing I'll say on behalf of Tapper and the others is that at least Tapper, and again, it's a low bar, but at least this time when he would ask the question, he would say, so would you raise taxes, even though, of course, obviously people would pay lower premiums too, so they would come out ahead. At least he introduced that kind of hedge to the question itself to kind of make clear that the question was a bit incomplete as it had been posed in previous venues. And in that sense, there was a kind of an incremental improvement, I think, in the questioning, you know, relative to where it had been before. But again, that said, why not just go all the way and say, how do the premia that are called taxes differ under your plan from the premia that are called, you know, premia paid to private insurance companies? That would be a more accurate way, I think, of framing the question. But again, at least I'll give him, you know, I'm in a generous mood, I suppose. So I'll give it to him that at least he acknowledged this time. I'm talking about Tapper. And again, I think this was emblematic of the other questioners, too. At least he acknowledged this time that it's a bit misleading, to say the least, to limit the question to what the tax effect would be.
Yeah, I know. I think maybe there's been a little brownout in Midtown or something. It was happening yesterday that there were brownouts in the city. Maybe something
that
caught us.
That did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good to be back.
Yeah, exactly. So, did you get a chance to answer the question? Maybe you didn't even hear it, about like what you felt about the questions that were posed by the hosts on CNN.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So good. So they were, I mean, I'm going to say that again, there's been a kind of an incremental or marginal improvement over where things in the last round of debates, and even over where they generally are in media interviews about Medicare for All. And in that sense, the questioning was better, but again, it's a low bar to begin with. So here's what I mean by that. You know, Mr. Tapper, of course, posed the question to both Bernie and to Liz about whether, you know, taxes would go up, you know, under Medicare for All. And I think Bernie, of course, was spot on in saying that, you know, the question effectively was a repetition of a Republican talking point. I had a beautiful cathartic moment when he said that, because it drives me crazy when the question is posed in that particular way. And I was really, you know, grateful to see Bernie call it out. But that being said, I will say maybe this much, and that is that at least Tapper did, when he posed the question about, well, would taxes go up, acknowledged in the question itself that even though, of course, I think he put it that way, even though, of course, you know, total, you know, net payment for medical care on the part of any individual would go down, at least he did that much, right? And again, this is a low bar. It's not a great accomplishment, but it's at least a marginal improvement over the way that question is typically posed. So in that sense, I suppose I would say, well, first of all, I think I would say that was that particular way in which Tapper would pose that question was kind of emblematic of the way the questioning went for the entire night. It was, I thought all of it was, again, marginally or incrementally better than it has been previously. But again, I would also say that's a kind of a low bar. It's still rather falling rather far short of, you know, sort of sensible framing of questions.
Yeah, so there's kind of actually what you're saying there is that the notions we have of like a level playing field or fair-mindedness or the media's role to be objective or a clear channel in some kind of way for the actual issues and really get at them has in fact in some subtle and not so subtle ways, it may seem subtle to some viewers and not subtle to others. You know, it has departed that, where there is some kind of value set or agenda that, in fact, they are enacting that, you know, is in some way offensive. I mean, not offensive as in I'm personally offended, but but offensive as in I'm on, you know, they're on the offense, you know, against certain policies or candidates. You know, how aware do you think this particular debate, you know, do you think this debate made this obvious to more people? Do you like the way, you know, how did the candidates push back to kind of, you know, raise awareness that this is not as neutral, fair, or favorable an environment as we might hope for from the press?
Yeah, so I think there were at least two respects in which that kind of built-in bias or that built-in tendency to sort of marginalize candidates who aren't, you know, sort of Clinton-style mid-1990s or early 1990s Democrats got across. So the first was the example that we were just talking about a moment ago where Bernie himself, I think, very, very helpfully pointed out that, you know, the way one particular question from Tapper, say, was framed did have the effect of basically repeating or underscoring or further disseminating a Republican talking point. Another example, I thought, was I thought both Liz and Bernie were rather good at kind of making clear that there's something absurd about the 15 seconds or the 30 seconds. They kind of threaded the needle, I thought, quite effectively in the sense that they would sort of abide by the rules. They didn't just kind of have a free-for-all or completely, you know, throw them out the window and thereby seem to be rule breakers or narcissists or whatever. They made clear that they were sort of trying to comport themselves in keeping with the rules on the one hand, while also getting across, I think, very effectively how inimical the rules that constitute the format are to the cause of actual sensible public deliberation over, you know, some of the most important choices that are now facing us as a polity and as a society.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, and you're right. You know, because it's kind of an irony that on the one hand, you know, the so-called liberal outlets that would be opposing Trump and, you know, boosting Democrats and hoping to for our society to have a breakthrough in this evolving situation of racism and white supremacy and business corruption and all the rest of it are in fact playing for the other side in a subtle way when, you know, when they pose these questions. In other words, there isn't, you know, there is an agenda. And as Bernie pointed out, you know, for example, in the debate over health care, you know, he with Delaney, you know, there is, you know, there was going to be pharmaceutical advertising, health care advertising. And even though this is something that we've normalized and taken for granted, it does play a role. In shaping that playing field. You know, I don't know if you know more than I do, but who is Delaney? Why is someone who's a former congressman actually on the stage and as a kind of an attack dog, taking time and energy and conflicting with the major candidates? I mean, you know, among the top three polling and funded candidates, you have this outlier person, you know, like kind of taking a lot of bandwidth and airtime.
Yeah. So I guess I sort of a couple of thoughts on that. I mean, the first is I don't know if I would call Delaney, you know, uniquely an outlier. It seems to me, and in a way, this actually makes the problem that you're highlighting even worse, or I think what I'm about to say might indicate that the problem you're highlighting is even worse. It seems to me, ironically enough, you've got like 10 people up there, and at least five of them are right-wing, well, maybe not, at least three or four of them are, you know, basically right-wing outliers, right? Delaney is one. This Tim Ryan fellow is another. Hickenlooper, of course, is one. And I think, really, to a significant degree, Bullock is too. And, you know, it's very odd, right, that close to half of the candidates up there are way, way, way out of what now is the center of the Democratic Party, right? I mean, they're just, they are themselves total right-wing or reactionary outliers. And so that, of course, invites a question, and that is, you know, it, basically your question, which is, you know, why? What are, not only what is Delaney doing there, but what are they doing there? What are those four at least doing there? And what are a bunch of them who are going to be on the stage tonight doing there? Now, it seems to me I can think of at least three possible answers. Two of them are really horrifying, and one of them is mildly horrifying, let's say. So I guess the most cynical reply would be, well, you know, the people who put these things on or the networks who televise them don't really care about public deliberation that's actually thoughtful and informed and informative. They really just care about entertainment, right? They sort of cast this whole thing as though it was, you know, Manny Pacquiao versus Floyd Mayweather or something, you know, some like big super fight. I mean, I almost, you know, threw up during the opening moments when, you know, all those sound effects were being played. They sort of, I half expected, you know, smudge pots or, you know, explosions and things. It was such a spectacle. And there was even this downright weirdly Orwellian thing that they did at the very beginning that I don't think I've ever seen before at all. And again, we've all seen quite a bit of awfulness, but this was like a new low when they sort of presumed to categorize or pigeonhole the candidates for us in advance of the debates even commencing, right? I remember on the screen they put Bernie and Liz together in like a little box and they say, the progressives! And then they show, you know, a couple of other people, and they say, the centrists, you know, and then they show another person, you know, the gay mayor of South Bend, right? And so they're sort of like playing up these weird tags that they seem to want us to attach to these people, and they seem to be doing it kind of in the way that is often done before a big sporting event, some big spectacle. So that's one possibility, is that this is really for them more about entertainment than anything else, and they knew that this Delaney guy is kind of a crank or kind of a character. I mean, the way the camera kept zooming in on those kind of, you know, half-crazed eyes of his, you know, as he was listening to sensible Democrats say sensible Democrat things. So that's one possibility, right? A second disturbing possibility, of course, is that the network itself or whoever makes these decisions want to make people like Bernie and Liz look like they themselves are the outliers, that they're radicals or that they're outside the mainstream of Democratic thinking. And so they're sort of, you know, including as many de facto Republicans in the pool as they can, so as to kind of give this general impression that the mean value is, you know, somewhere to the right of what Richard Nixon would have been. That's another possibility. And then I think the third, which is the least cynical and the most forgivable, although still not really forgivable, is that maybe the people who make these decisions are themselves just actually ill-informed and operating under significant, you know, sort of epistemic disabilities when it comes to sort of knowing where the public is now. Right? I mean, presumably the people who make these decisions are pretty comfortable. They're probably doing quite well. They might very well be part of the 1%, or at the very least, maybe, you know, the 5% or the 10%. And so and oftentimes people like this can be kind of blinkered about what the real plight of the proverbial average Jane or Joe is. And so maybe some of them actually believe that Delaney is a kind of centrist Democrat, while Bernie and Liz are kind of wild-eyed radicals who are at the left fringes of the current party orthodoxy. It's, I suppose it's possible some of them really believe that. And I just, but I don't know one way or the other. Even if they do believe it, though, there's still faultworthiness here. I mean, to use lawyer lingo, at the very least, they are culpably negligent in thinking that. And if not, you know, outright reckless in thinking that. And it's even tempting to think it's not about negligence or recklessness at all, that it's actually intentional, that they're basically just trying to stack the deck, or that they're just trying to make this into an entertainment spectacle, you know, and you know, devil take the actual facts of the matter.
And the results of the public knowing the facts at this very critical moment, both in terms of democracy as well as, you know, the future viability of human life on Earth in a destabilizing environment, which is, of course, kept off the table. I mean, I have to say that I had this strange experience, and I'll share it briefly, which was that it was just, let's see, I believe it was actually last summer that I had occasion to be in a place where a particular Democratic senator was presenting in a small group setting, and then we had the opportunity to ask questions. And so my question was, given Trump and all that we are concerned about and fear about concerning him, would the Democratic Party strongly consider getting a lead on defeating him by going with the popular choice candidate, you know, this Bernie Sanders, a highly popular candidate, and as we've seen, you know, he's still popular. He's still running in the top three in terms of polling. He's doing great on fundraising that, you know, kind of sets him apart from everyone in terms of, you know, his not being prey to financial incentives or wealthy donors or anything by virtue of fundraising, you know, by the ordinary people who then he turns around and serves. So, you know, my question was, if we're so fearful of Trump, if the message is not Trump, anything but Trump, why would one not consider going with someone who's caucused with the Democratic Party and has such a wide recognition and lead? This particular senator fell stumbling back, and I thought he was almost going to fall over in, like, kind of ill-preparedness to respond to this question, and he was like, oh, no, no, no. I want to see all the... I said, why should we go shopping for candidates now in this dire situation? And he said, no, I want to see every possible candidate. I want to look at all the candidates. And it's kind of like, you know, sort of a, I don't know, this is a horrible metaphor, but, you know, somebody kind of saying that they want to, if this is a horrible metaphor, excuse me, women, but if somebody said, I want to date 30 men, like, what would that tell you about their, or a man said, I want to date 30 women, you know, what would that tell you about, you know, their genuine interest in, you know, kind of landing on somebody? And, you know, of course, when it comes to one's personal life, you can do anything you want, but here we, you know, if that's the preference, fantastic, you know. But it's like, if you can manage it, you know, you have a right to it. But on the other hand, you know, when it comes to, you know, taking, assuring that an authoritarian, white supremacist who's undermining the moral fabric and economy of this country and completely denying climate change, you know, moves onward, why would anyone want to? And so when I heard that, I was like, oh, well, this is the plan. And sure enough, it is. So part of this plan has been engendered by the Democratic Party itself, it seems, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm with you on that, Allison. I think I see it basically that way as well, right? And once again, it seems to me that you can, there are at least two sort of interpretations or sort of explanations sounding in the motives or the sort of orientations or the assumptions or the beliefs held by those who make the decisions as to who's going to be included in the forum and who's not, and you know how various participants in the forum are going to be characterized and how they're not. You know, the most cynical, I'll start with that one, is that, yeah, if you yourself would like to see the Democratic Party effectively basically just be what the Republican Party was, let's say, circa 1976 or something, then, you know, it would probably be good strategy for you, if you're able to call these kinds of shots, to say, well, I'm going to dilute the voices of those who are actually at the core of contemporary Democratic thinking, namely Bernie and Liz, and I'm going to dilute their voices by, you know, including, you know, 19 other, or actually, I guess we're talking like 23 other candidates who are not really, you know, contemporary Democrats at all, but are more like 1976 Republicans at best. That would be one possible motive and explanation. And another, again, would be just a kind of mistakenness in one's thinking about where the Democratic Party is now. That is a culpable mistakenness. It is, again, a kind of negligence, a kind of reckless or, at the very least, negligent sort of ignorance about where the party is. And then that could lead to this sort of thing as well. But when you think about what's really kind of strange is if you took, right, maybe let's say take the bottom 15 candidates and add up all of that. And I'm going to bracket out Marianne for the moment because I think she is in a certain sense kind of sui generis. But all of the these kind of centrist, so-called centrist, but actually right-wing Democrats, if you added or summed up the percentage of the electorate that expresses, you know, interest in those, let's say, 15 or 10 to 15 people, I would bet you anything that the total number that you would arrive at would be less than the number of either Bernie or Liz, and probably less than of course, the numbers that would be associated with two or three of the other candidates as well. And the lesson I would draw from that isn't necessarily that we should just, you know, marginalize and tell those 15 just to go take a hike or whatever, but I would think that you ought to start winnowing out the marginals with some degree of expedition, you know, fairly soon, because otherwise we really are conveying this kind of false impression to the public that Bernie and Liz are kind of outliers rather than those 10 or 15 actually being the outliers. You know, it's very odd. Maybe one other point that might be worth making here, Allison, is that, you know, this is another thing where I don't know whether it's intentional or whether it's just reflective of a bias of which people aren't aware that they hold, right? But there's always a baseline implied in any question that somebody poses or any claim that somebody makes about trying to, you know, be as inclusive as possible or trying to be sort of as centrist as possible, or we should all gather around, you know, somebody who's going to beat Trump. You know, that's job one, is to beat Trump. Often, you know, sort of implied and not stated in an admonition of that sort is the sort of what would follow the ellipsis, which is, and therefore get behind Biden, or and therefore, you know, get behind X, and without realizing that, you know, the admonition that they're laying on us militates at least as forcefully in the other direction. In other words, it means at least it's at least as the conclusion that you should that the Biden supporters, let's say, should get behind Bernie instead is at least as compellingly implicated or implied by that so-called imperative that it's beating Trump is number one, as is the putative imperative that, you know, the Bernie people should just kind of hang up their, you know, call it a day and get behind Biden, right? They never actually directly address that question, right? And the hope seems to be that we will just think that it follows as a matter of sort of inexorable logic that, you know, if A, then B, with A here being that, you know, beating Trump is job one, and B being that therefore, you know, go Biden. And, you know, some people are good at noting this, right? Every now you see rejoinders offered by some people saying, well, if that's what you think, then why don't you get behind Bernie? And again, that follows at least as inexorably as does, you know, any conclusion to the effect that you should be getting behind some fake Democrat.
Yes. Yes, it does. And that's, I mean, that was implicit. That was my question, is why does it always, you know, choose the senator? Why does it always go that one way? And we never, and then it's kind of like, you know, it's never assumed or questioned that perhaps it should go the other way. And then you have, I mean, this is a bit of a deviation from our topic here, but then you have something like the Bernie bro meme, the leftover, undigested, unrecognized, upset and blame and resentment, misdirected toward progressives from the 2016 election. You know, so, you know, and this actually, you know, which all kind of contribute to then, I mean, if there are 20, you know, 18 to 19 potentially superfluous people on the stage, the majority of them are white men. Perhaps there are some white women in that group, too. You can't really claim it's a very diverse group at all. I mean, in fact, it's actually notable for, in a sense, its lack of diversity. You know, so, you know, but somehow the groove is constantly worn down in that direction, even making Bernie himself, and this goes to, you know, another news item that's out there, the target for people's upset with white men, you know, the upset of, you know, like calling all of the Bernie supporters of all ages, of all genders, of all ethnicities and races and everything else, you know, as kind of young, in some ways, disagreeable young men. You know, it's actually a complete mischaracterization. And yet, you know, but then nobody kind of sees an array of you know, more Republican-oriented white men on the stage and finds that odd. instead, they seek to blame, you know, the one person who has been seeking to correct these problems from a more holistic framework, you know, for 40 years.
So, you know, yeah, for decades even, right? No, I totally agree. I mean, the Bernie bro thing and sort of similar attempts to sort of tar Bernie or tar other real Democrats and the kind of, I don't know, that sort of strategy, I guess, to sort of get people to sort of Pavlovianly associate a particular candidate with a particular unpleasant thing, even maybe the color orange or with you know, kind of jarring mixtures of plaids and stripes or something. It's hard not to think that that is intentional. I can't even imagine that there's a negligence or mere recklessness explanation for that. And the reason that I am inclined to think that way on the motives question, at least in connection with this particular matter, is that the tarring is just so wildly implausible that there's simply no way, there's no plausible way, it seems to me, to say, oh, well, this is a kind of an Achilles heel of Bernie that his opponents have seized upon and magnified. This is not even an Achilles heel. This is like literally a non-thing, right? There's just nothing to it. And that means it has to have been invented entirely from whole cloth. I actually do think it's on all fours with the W. Bush campaign's Swift Voters for Truth thing, you know, back in 2004, where they just invent a claim that John Kerry wasn't, you know, piloting a Swift boat and, you know, acting, you know, heroically in the interest of Imperial America, and sort of try to get people to think that he was a quote unquote coward instead for, you know, for not actually, you know, taking part as a naval officer or naval person in that war. I think they just invented it, and it's almost as if they took a page right out of Mein Kampf or something. I think it's in Mein Kampf. It's in something that Hitler wrote, that if you want to tell a lie, and, you know, politically, and you want the lie to work, if you want the lie to stick, it's much better to go with a big lie than a little lie, because people will figure that I think the thought is that the thought process of the audience of the lie is going to be roughly as follows. well, that's so wildly crazy what's being said that nobody would say it unless it's true. And therefore, it must be true, right? And it seems to be that Karl Rove basically took that page right out of the Hitler playbook by, you know, having George W. Bush tell really wild-ass lies, pardon my French, which is crazy lies, that a theory that maybe people will believe them if they're even crazier, because they'll, again, in the backs of their minds think, well, they have to be true because nobody would actually try to, you know, pass that off as truth unless it were. And I think the anti-Bernie folk who claim to be Democrats, they have to have been acting similarly. They have to have invented out of whole cloth the Bernie bro meme, and they probably were thinking something like, well, that one is so, you know, so completely beyond the pale and so completely implausible that people will think that there must be truth to it or else it wouldn't be being propagated. Because, again, there's just nothing there. You know, I can understand, you know, if somebody were to say, okay, what are Bernie's possible weaknesses, at least in relative terms? Well, they might say, oh, he always seems angry. You know, he's always fulminating or something. So let's magnify that and exaggerate it and play it up. Or if they said, well, he's kind of old, you know, he's 77, my God, you know, we better not vote for him, we should vote for Biden instead because he's only 76. You know, that's at least, you know, there's at least a basis for that claim, however unjust the claim is. But the Bernie bro thing, it's just like a total UFO to me. I just, where did that come from? I remember thinking that when it first started circulating in 2015 or 2016, I thought, what? I mean, it kind of, it'd be like saying, you know, Bernie, we now know, actually came here from Neptune. And so, you know, Bernie's got a Neptune problem. You know, Bernie's got a significant Achilles heel because he comes from Neptune. I mean, it was that absurd. You can't look at the guy's supporters. You can't look at the demographics of his primary sort of sources of support. You can't look at his team. You can't look at the various people who are supporting him. And not a single one looks like a bro. You know? And ironically, you know, the supporters of those who are opposing Bernie very often look like bros or the functional equivalent of bros or creatures who are at least as objectionable as bros. But I kind of wish, I remember in 15 or 16, that somebody would just like put together a meme of Bernie, you know, with a towel around his waist in a locker room snapping towels at people and saying, yeah, here he is, Bernie the bro, right? And how, you know, how plausible is this image, right?
That's really funny. Maybe, well, you know, that's really interesting that you actually bring out that image, because, you know, we do know that this Bernie bro meme is likely the creation of David Brock, who, you know, was himself a longstanding right-wing operative, who was responsible for the denigration and railroading out of the conversation of Anita Hill back during the time of the Clarence Thomas nomination. And, you know, and so even this, and even, you know, the bro imagery would be kind of more reflective of his own mind and imagination, perhaps, than the people he's trying to characterize. You know, and maybe he had some, you know, insightful purchase, intuitive purchase, such as anyone who, you know, is in advocacy or certainly for a propagandist, an outright propagandist, which is what he is, would have to have, you know, to what would be an image that would be, you know, kind of subtly but irritatingly contagious for, you know, for disaffected women who had had painful experiences under patriarchy and were part of the same kind of group needing to recover, you know, as, and therefore sadly enlistable in this way, you know, which actually does also go to what Marianne brings into the conversation, Marianne Williamson, which I really like. I don't feel that, you know, we will have the luxury at this critical time of having a recovery presidency or that any of that is kind of feasible or likely. But the fact that there are things to be healed, which even what happened in 2016 is something that really needs to be unpacked and healed, because clearly when we don't heal these things and we just kind of march on toward profit, success, and growth in denial of all that we, you know, that is kind of fomenting in, you know, the collective
psyche in some kind of way,
mm-hmm.
you know, these things don't get healed. And I so, and instead they march on, and they kind of can, even well-intentioned people can, through their own sorrow, pain, or trauma, be recruited into something quite toxic and
mm-hmm.
destructive, you know. So I really did really appreciate her being there on the stage and opening up, you know, that domain, and as well as really, you know, she also called out context, because here we had corporate shills. You know, we had Delaney for healthcare and apparently the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which she espoused during the day, which is amazing.
Talk about UFOs.
And then, you know, Hickenlooper, who's a well-known gas and oil shill, none of that is named, but they are there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and present. And so she was able, and of course, I think, you know, Bernie and Liz and calling them out as Republican talking points, and, you know, the fact that, they, you know, Bernie called out that Delaney himself profits from what he's representing there on the stage. But she really did did bring up the overall context of the, you know, the lack of, you know, why we really can't be trusting people who are speaking with forked tongue and have mixed motives.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think there are a lot of really wonderful things that Marianne brings into you know, the sort of the overall discourse or what passes for, you know, public deliberation right now, with respect to or as to, you know, who we're going to put in the White House and what the Congress is going to look like and what policies are going to be pursued after January of 2021. But one of the many things that she contributes that I think deserves sort of special mention is she really does, I think, this is something she does, I think, uniquely. I don't think any other candidate does this. She really draws our attention to the what we might think of as the subliminal element in the public deliberation, right? If we sort of crudely distinguish, just for the sake of convenience, it's a rough and ready distinction, but if we sort of crudely distinguish between liminal and subliminal sort of forces at work in public deliberation and public decision making, we might say that you know, both are operative. And that the more impoverished or the less developed or the less the venue is congenial to actual sort of sentence-long claims or paragraph-long arguments or multiple paragraph-long arguments, the less congenial our political process is to that kind of deliberation, which is, I think, what people usually have in mind when they use a word like that. The more, I think, the subliminal, the greater the role that the subliminal element plays. And what that means, of course, for our purposes then would be that the subliminal element probably plays a much greater role in driving, you know, public deliberation and decision making, or public thinking and decision making now, even than it did, say, 20 years ago or 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. It just seems like we get more and more subliminal and less liminal the more that, you know, kind of mainstream mass media determine the formatting of the debate itself. And what that means is that the door is opened for somebody like a Trump, who basically is pure id. You know, he's pure subliminal. The man can't even utter a word coherently, let alone a sentence or a paragraph or a treatise, right? And so Marianne, I think, is spot on when she says, look, this is what Trump is doing. This is what he's channeling. Now, other people have said this or have remarked on this as well, right? Even back in 2016, people said that the vote for Trump is basically giving a finger to the establishment or something, which is, I suppose, another way of saying something almost the same thing, right? But the thing that I think what separates Marianne even from those people is she sort of puts her finger right on it as a kind of an enduring human capacity or an enduring human vulnerability or an enduring human frailty, right? That, in other words, it's not like, you know, it just happens to be the case that you can get traction by giving the finger to the establishment right now. This is a deep part of what we are as creatures, and we have to recognize that and then sort of formulate policy and formulate advocacy of policy with that in mind. And she does that spectacularly well. You know, I think, first of all, in highlighting the problem, in elaborating on the problem and sort of taking the measure of the problem and then communicating to us the measure of the problem, and then also then in responding to it. She's right. I mean, to sort of sum it up, I guess, she's right, I think, in portraying Trump as a kind of a weird, perverse kind of religious figure almost, like a kind of, he's what passes in the current era for a prophet of a kind, but a false prophet in the old, to use the old lingo. And she's, I think, trying to bring a kind of similarly prophetic voice into the process that is a prophetic voice that's coming from a place of love rather than a place of fear or hatred. And if that, you know, if that carries over, I mean, if Liz and Bernie, for example, pick up on that and do the same thing, then she, even just having, you know, got them to do it will have been a great contribution on her part. But I actually hope that she just kind of stays in the race, and I actually hope that she has some kind of role in whatever administration takes the White House in January of 2021. I'm not sure exactly what the role would be or what the name of the position would be, but it seems to me that, you know, this is a serious enough and long festering enough problem, and it seems to be the identification of it as a matter of public policy, as something that is of concern to public policy, is sufficiently new and is sufficiently unwidespread still to this point, that I think this is going to be a long-term kind of process of healing that we're going to have to engage in as a great big first-person plural we. And I think Marianne is especially well-situated to sort of continue that public healing process even after the elections. And so I do hope that she has some sort of quasi-permanent or official position, as it were, to kind of help with that continuing effort even after we retake the White House, whether it be with her or not with her as the top of the ticket.
I have a very similar observation because, you know, as a woman journalist, right, you know, a lot of the rules of what we're supposed to be doing in journalism is providing, you know, left-brained, concrete, provable, cognitive kinds of information. And so because journalism, for example, has been, you know, dominated by men and was kind of shaped by men, of course, now it's completely shaped by, you know, advertising and profit, you know, and these other horrible corporate agendas. But, you know, back when it was considered to be pure, and it still, you know, carries among many journalists the values of, you know, you prove what you say, you don't draw conclusions, you link to other known facts and quote them directly. So on the one side, we have these people wildly extrapolating. And yet, you know, on the sort of liberal or progressive side, we're, you know, we're trying to kind of keep our noses clean by being left-brained. And yet, therefore, fail in our ability to enlist women who have not been trained for access into these privileged, you know, male domains, you know, for the most part. And it is a struggle to even be in that role. So we don't enlist women, and we also don't enlist the emotional intelligence and the value sets of caring and compassion that, you know, were kind of put aside or dissociated from or truncated in order to participate in a profit-driven system that denigrates, you know, the life force, health, and, in fact, our, you know, interconnected planetary bioecological systems, which are living systems that, you know, are where we come from and really sustain us. So there is a big disconnect, and yet when you go off, you know, the reservation, so to speak, bring in more emotional, body-centered wisdom, you know, it's considered a kind of deviation. So I certainly, for one, you know, exactly, you know, resonate with the dilemma and the need for what you're describing, and I think we need, you know, better models across the board at integrating all of that, speaking to it and integrating it. So I certainly, you know, applauded much of what she had to say, and I have some caveats about it, but we don't as well, because I think because some of this comes out of A, a celebrity tradition, B, mm-hmm. a guru tradition, C, a religious thought leader tradition, which are all authoritarian and an abdication of personal power, you know, in effect. There are caveats that I have along those lines, you know, because people have different beliefs and different, you know, kind of traditions. And so for anyone, I think it's been a terrible error that Trump was, you know, kind of took and attracted that power. And, you know, and I do have concerns about replicating it as well.
Yeah, I mean, for what it's worth, my thought on that as a general matter is that, you know, I like your use of the word integrate or integration when it comes to the sort of the liminal and the subliminal, or the more sort of emotional intelligence with the more sort of, you know, just pure cognitive or racinative or calculative intelligence. It seems to me that they really do have to be integrated. And I think one prerequisite to them being sort of optimally integrated is that they both be on the surface rather than one being hidden beneath the surface, as the prefix sub in the word subliminal sort of suggests. And I think one of the great things, one of the many great things that Marion does, is she sort of pulls the subliminal up from underwater and puts it up at the surface along with the liminal. And it seems to me that once we do that, then we're able, in a more, I think, again, deliberate and sort of fully cognizant way, integrate, you know, the emotional with the racinative, insofar as those things are divisible, or to integrate the subliminal with the liminal, again, insofar as those things are distinguishable. And I think one of the things that enables Trump to sort of get by with what he gets by with is precisely the fact that the subliminal stays subliminal, because people are then sort of less aware of what is prompting them and what is prompting their reactions. And when they're less aware of that, I think in general they're more vulnerable to its continuing to operate in that way, right? In other words, if you don't know what it is in your person that Trump is kind of appealing to, you're much more likely, I think, to submit and go along and let him seduce you in the way that, you know, authoritarian, sort of charismatic dictator types always have done. But if you pull it up from beneath the water and it's on the surface in the plain light of day, and you can look at it and you can see it, you can witness its operations and make yourself aware of how it is, you know, what the mechanics are pursuant to which it is affecting your thinking and your affect, even your leaning, then you can, you know, you have a bit more mastery over it, so to speak, right? And I think that that's something that's really been missing from American politics, at least for the last 60 or 70 years, as far as I can tell, and maybe forever, because, again, this is the first moment at which I'm aware of an actual candidate for the presidency who's on a debate stage with other actual candidates for the presidency actually calling attention to that element and saying that we have to be always cognizant of it in that kind of sustained attention sort of way. And in that sense, I think she represents a real moment in American political consciousness, and one that I want, sort of to repeat in a way what I said a moment ago, that is a moment that I think should be extended into an eternity, right? We should pull that up to the surface and always be, you know, from, you know, henceforth, we should always be, I think, mindful of that sort of subliminal element that includes a number of the drivers of the way that we incline to vote or incline to think or incline to approve or disapprove or what have you.
Yeah, I can see that too. And in fact, you know, I think there could be and should be ways to create safe spaces and community conversations so that people can own these difficult things in a supportive environment without light shame and guilt, which is, you know, and fear of survival and community rejection and scapegoating, which is one of the ways that people then will suppress their own ability to recognize these things. Anyway, this is a whole other doorway that we're opening as we come to the end of the time here. so, you know, but yeah, no, I completely agree with that. And actually there's a lot more to say about that. It's so rare to actually be able to consider, what that kind of healing would look like and the places that it could go. So I certainly applaud that, and I think it's very, very helpful, and needed. It's desperately, desperately needed. Thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots, Bob. It's always a pleasure to talk with you and hear your thinking on these things and your feeling responses on these things. So thank you so much for joining to connect the dots audience on today's show.
Thanks so much, Allison. Again, it's the same here. It's always a joy and a learning experience to talk to you, and it's been great to be able to talk about this stuff in particular at this very fateful time. So thanks so much for having me on, and I'm looking forward, of course, to continuing our many conversations in future.
Me too. And thank you, listeners, for being with us on today's Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. If you've enjoyed this program, share it in archives, where it will be at the connectthedots.podbean.com with your friends and in social media. Heads up, keep marching forward in company with all our relations.